Hello, everyone. On this episode of the podcast, I sit down with Oscar. Now, Oscar is by far and away the most requested person to be on the podcast. So it was good to sit down with him and have a chat, being that he is the very first student of higher jiu-jitsu, if you don't include John himself. Now, we start off talking about how Oscar got involved in martial arts. He joined SPMA, and we talk about all of his competitions. And then through that, we talk about how he got exposed, or he met John, and then John, a little while down the track, started the commune, which then became higher jiu-jitsu. And Oscar trained with John at the commune and is obviously in our gym now. And throughout the podcast, Oscar shares a couple of altercations or incidents that occurred outside of jiu-jitsu. And it's just interesting to hear his perspective on things, being that he was the very first student. He's refereed, he basically is an assistant coach in the gym, and he trains himself. So he's got a lot of different avenues to talk about. And throughout the podcast, I think we did a pretty good job of covering them. And I really appreciate Oscar's willingness to be candid and to be open and honest about a lot of it. So thanks very much, and I hope you all enjoy. Cheers. Oscar, we have been here planning on doing this one for quite some time.
We sure have.
And I've got to say, and I hate to say it, This has been the most requested person. You are the most requested person on this podcast.
Thank you, everyone.
And people are interested to hear your perspective from a multitude of angles.
Yeah, man.
And I think both from your experience with jiu-jitsu, you've so many wide areas with teaching, refereeing, training, competing, so many angles there that are going to be interesting, which we'll touch on. And the other side is that you're just a good bloke and a funny.
Thanks, bro.
And funny. So,
thanks, bro. I try.
I guess the first question I'd like to ask people is, what was your very first experience with martial arts? Doesn't even have to be jiu-jitsu, but just the very first thing that got you interested.
Okay, so to kick things off, when I was in high school, for want of a better term, I was a bit of a troll, and I liked to pick fights with people and then run away, because that was my specialty. Now, one time I picked a fight with a guy called Billy, and Billy just whooped my ass. Like, I can't even describe to you how badly he, I wouldn't say beat me, but, you know, controlled. And Billy was also the enforcer at our high school, right? So he was really just unnaturally strong. I could never work out how, or obviously it was jits.
He was on TRT, bro.
So Billy was so strong that, and he was so good at fighting that whenever, you know, any kid wanted to bully me, they would bully me, and then I'd get angry, and then they'd hide behind Billy, right? And I could never work out why Billy was good. But when I finished high school, I walked into a gym for an SPMA, which I'll get to later, but I walked into SPMA, and the first class I went to, Billy was there. And that was the moment that I realized that, oh, hey, hang on, that's how he was so good at fighting. Now, Billy and myself actually became close friends in the last year of high school, and we talked a lot about UFC and MMA and that sort of stuff, because we just had a massive obsession for Pride. Not UFC, Pride. So Pride fighting in Japan. So that was really my first big exposure to it. Then after high school, I got absolutely obsessed with Hoist Gracie, specifically because, to me, I don't like, and this is probably just in my own imagination, I imagine myself as Hoist Gracie. I was just like, that's my doppelganger in the ring. So every time he wins, I win.
Right.
So that's how I really thought of jiu-jitsu and martial arts and stuff. So and of course, you know, I lived locally to SPMA. So when I first Googled it, SPMA came up as the closest gym to me.
Right.
And so I decided that I'd give martial arts a shot, thinking, okay, I can walk in there and from day one I'll be Hoist Gracie, and whatever huge guy that I see I can just take down and whoop his ass. But obviously we know that that's not true, and I just got my ass like handed to me. And I remember one time there was a girl that walked into the gym, and I really wanted to impress her, and so I decided, I was like, hey, you know, look, this is what jiu-jitsu is. And I went to, and I picked out this big guy in the gym, and I was like, I'll show you what jiu-jitsu is. And I tried to take him down, and he guillotined me really badly instantly. And that was really my first week of jiu-jitsu.
Right.
And the second week I went to jiu-jitsu, two other big things happened. Helio Gracie died, and that's how I know that that was the day that I started jits. And
so what day is that?
Oh my god, it's like January 29th, 2009.
There you go. Wow. Almost 10 years.
That's really my beginning, the beginning of my journey. All those little things that just kind of added up. But especially Billy. Billy's now a black belt, by the way. He runs Movement Martial Arts. We're still friends. We still see each other all the time.
Where is that gym?
Movement Martial Arts is in Epping, I think. But it's, right. Yeah, he's still training, and he's a black belt now.
Right. So you said you and Billy became friends in the last year of school.
Yeah.
And is that... That was around the time you started jiu-jitsu?
No, that was around the time he started jiu-jitsu.
Right, okay. And when did you start? Like, how old were you?
I started when I was 19, right. I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what sort of experience did you have initially training at SPMA, like in the first, you know, first couple of years, I guess? How, like, what was it like?
So it's quite funny, right? So the day I started, because we always lined up in a circle, right? And the instructor was on one side and... the white belt was on the, you know, the other side, and we always lined up in order of rank. And I remember being told by Elvis that, you know, that one day on a long enough timeline, I'd sit on the other side of the circle. And I always thought to myself that that day would never happen. And I spent every day at SPMA was like a war. There would be battles. I remember... I walked in my second or third week, and Crocop was there. So Crocop was a pride fighter and a guy that I've been following on YouTube for many years. And he was kicking the bag, and it sounded like thunder. And I just remember thinking, like, because he used to say, you know, right kick hospital, left kick morgue. that was Crocop, and he was there, and everyone's just. I'm casually, you know, just watching the lesson. I'm like, don't you know that's Crocop? Like, can no one hear that? Is no one seeing this? Am I crazy here? But no, everyone was lovely. But as soon as you do the high five and the fist bump, it was just on.
Yeah.
And that's also where I met John. Like, he would have been there the first month I was there. And I was a skinny kid.
He was already there.
He was already there. So a few weeks after I joined, he got his blue belt. I remember,
right.
Yeah, I remember this.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Johnny.
So he'd been to Brazil at that point, right?
He'd been to Brazil at that point, and he just got back from Brazil.
Right.
And he was just a unit of a dude. Like, oh my gosh. I would have been, so in my head, I was about like Taryn's build.
Right.
Or, maybe Nick.
Right.
Ben. Yeah, Ben, Nick, that kind of size. And Johnny was like Aaron Morelli, but a bit bigger.
Right.
He was just a unit of a dude.
And he knew a lot more
jiu-jitsu. And he knew a lot more jiu-jitsu, yeah. I remember we rolled one time, and he threw me on the other side of the room, and I was just absolutely in awe of the fact that someone had that kind of power behind them. Obviously, I know that he had trained in Brazil, and... he was good, but yeah, he just threw me all over the shop. It was crazy. But yeah,
I was going to ask you, how So he got his blue belt like a couple of weeks after you joined the gym. And it was funny when I spoke to Matt last week and his episode was released on Friday.
Yeah.
He was saying, firstly, and I'll give you an opportunity to throw some shade at him, because he was saying that when he first met you, he thought you were a dickhead.
Yeah, I thought it.
and secondly,
yeah.
he said that when he met you, I think you had 3 or 4 stripes on your white belt.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting to see the three of you join the gym at separate times and be in such early stages of your careers and now look like at all three of his like best mates and completely different, much further ahead. What was your experience meeting Matt a little bit later on?
So I remember the first time I met Matt, because we kind of were training, and look, for the longest time I used to use jiu-jitsu as an outlet for my internal anger. Because you could use it to obviously, you know, fight.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to fight, then you could just let out all that energy. And Matt was the first person I met who, no matter how hard I fought, he was still there. Like, he was still in it.
Yeah.
But I didn't like him, because obviously I couldn't get my rage out and tap him. And I didn't tap him that day. And I was like, oh, screw you, man. But, years later, obviously we're friends, but I do remember very early on that I was like, I've been doing this for a year. You know, in my head, I was like, I'm so much more experienced than you. Why can't I tap you? But it was good. I think in hindsight, it really kind of builds a bond, because I got my purple belt and he got his blue belt on the same day.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah. I still have that photo somewhere.
Yeah.
I've
seen it actually on Facebook.
I've seen it. Yeah.
And so how early on, so the main focus in that gym was, like you said, it was a bit of a war.
It was fighting,
So there was, and there's a heavy focus on competition, right?
Definitely competition. Like John and Shahar ran it. Oh my gosh, I remember this. I'll tell you this story, right? Because John and Shahar, so Shahar is the is a black belt now. But those two were the main competitors of SBMA. And they ran an internal competition. And I'd only been training jits like a month, 2 months. And because, you know, obviously under that system, they really, really wanted to do competition and win at competitions. And so John and Shahar, obviously being the two main competitors, they made their own competition internally. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll join. And I was paired up against, my first match was against this guy called, I'm shitting on everybody. I think his name was Terrence Fox. That's the name that sticks in my head. And I was matched up to this guy, and he'd been training the exact same amount of time that I did, and he basically took me down, and then went to side control, and then mounted me, and then got a mounted Americana.
Shit.
And cranked on the mounted Americana, and I wouldn't tap. I remember looking at my arm bending funny, and everyone was like, ooh, and I wouldn't tap. And for some reason, I didn't want to tap at that moment. And I think Shahar was reffing, or Johnny was reffing, one of them was reffing, but and I didn't want to tap at that moment. And then I eventually worked my way back to close guard. I knew nothing about anything. And the only move that I could think of doing was a move called the Scorpion Crusher, which I have now since learned is not a move. It's just an absolute waste of time. But I did it, and I'm happy to show it to anybody in the gym, but it was just absolutely useless. But I remember, because that guy just demolished our division, right?
Right.
Our weight division, and he won. He was just a weapon. But I saw him like 2 months later, and I tapped him like 5 times in our role.
Right.
Because some people don't progress, and they don't have the desire to progress. It's because it's just a staying game. Like, as long as you stick at it,
yeah,
you'll get better over time. But yeah, the gym was definitely focused on competition and MMA. MMA especially. MMA.
They have a lot of fighters. Even at the fight night I went to with John quite a while back, there was quite a few SBMA fighters out of that gym.
Yeah, So back when I started at that gym, they had a guy called Shane Nix. He was the middleweight champion of CFC. He actually lost his belt, I think, to... So he tore his ACL, and then Hector Lombard took that belt.
Wow.
And then And obviously Hector Lombard went to the UFC.
Mm.
But Shane Nix was essentially the guy, like he was the man. And I went to an MMA class when I was still a white belt, and I got paired up with Shane, and I'll never forget how many times I got punched in the face that day from he didn't care. He just he punched me a lot, and then he tore his ACL, so
karma. Joke's on him.
Joke's on him.
So how did you you keep saying things like competition focused, war sort of thing, in the internal bloody competitions inside SPMA itself. Outside of the people that were competing, what was it like, or what was the philosophies of the head instructors, and what was it like learning under them? I mean, obviously the competition focused, but I'm sure there's still a lot to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. So Elvis and Anthony, it's quite interesting looking back on it in hindsight. So Elvis was very much famous for his guard, and Anthony was famous for top position, right? As in, by famous, I mean Elvis was in, you know, in MMA, he would use his guard.
Yeah.
And that was just unheard of. I lost him a lot of fights, but anyway. And Anthony loved the top position. So in terms of their philosophies of jits, they always liked to talk about pushing the pace and constantly, you know, maintaining this game speed at all times, so you know, having that one gear of go, which for athletes is fine, but there was a lot of people that didn't work for. You just tell, the dropout rate was just absurd. So many people who were blessed with athletic bodies held out over a long period because they just had athletic traits.
Yeah. So they'd survive. People that were a bit more everyday.
Yeah.
Everyday people, so to speak.
Exactly.
Would struggle.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that speaks to a lot of gyms, not just them.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've since split, and they have, in every competition I go to now, they are still the two of the biggest competition teams, and they've split as gyms.
Right. Wow.
So yeah, that says a lot about how heavily competition focused they are, and as well obviously how much they emphasize just going flat out no matter what.
Mm. So role times then, like, it's not, you know how we talk about John talks about, you know, this role's like goes for, it's 20-minute role kind of thing. I mean, it doesn't always go that long, but sort of emphasis on surviving, staying in it, not exerting too much energy, like being in it long term, because that's at the end of the day, like in a struggle for survival, like that's what you need to be able to do.
Yeah,
it's just interesting, like the change of tune and the focus in the gym.
Yeah. So absolutely, the idea behind their training was jiu-jitsu is a sport, most of all. Your roles go for 5 minutes.
You just need to last that.
Yeah, and you just need to last that. And I would always look up at the clock at random times to see, okay, how much time do I have to sweep this person?
Yeah.
Or submit this person, or get my 2 points, or get my 4 points, or.
So you would roll in the gym.
Yeah,
and be thinking about.
I'd be counting points in my head.
Everyone would be doing that?
Almost everybody would be doing it. I know for a fact John was doing it. I know for a fact because one time we rolled and he swept me and pinned me in side control, and I guarantee he counted 3 seconds before he started moving again, because everyone was like that. Yeah, I'm not obviously crapping on John, but
no,
that was everyone did
if,
that.
If that's the environment you're in and you're learning, you're still learning self-defense, you're still learning jiu-jitsu, you're still having a good time, like that's just, if that's the environment you're in, that's just how you're going to be. You're a product of the environment.
Yeah,
absolutely. So that's what you expect, I guess.
Yeah.
How long had you been training before you started competing?
Yeah.
And at what belts have you competed at?
Talk me through that. That's an interesting question. So I've competed at every belt now that I've been at. I haven't competed for 4 years, and I've no desire to compete. Now, I did start competing after that Terrence Fox incident, the John competition.
Mm-hmm.
I started to look at jiu-jitsu in terms of needing to prove that I was good at it, because tapping people in the gym that hadn't been training as long as I had, or hadn't come to as many classes, just didn't seem like a feasible thing to do. Which, I mean, in hindsight is obviously very, like a toxic kind of way to look at jiu-jitsu, but I didn't see that at the time. All I saw was the idea that I needed to push myself and prove myself, because that's what competition was all about. So I competed at white belt. I started with events jiu-jitsu, where I lost a bunch of first round matches. Then we got to the state championships, and I got to the quarterfinals. So that would have been bronze medal match.
Yeah.
And then I lost the bronze medal match, so then obviously I got nothing. But in that instance, I sort of started to see that, oh, hey, hang on. You can win. You just got to fight really hard. I was in a match, my first match, I remember this, where the guy had me on points. I think it was like 8-10, maybe nil. Mm-hmm. Like, he mounted me, went to side control. Finally, I recovered guard in the last 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And my coach just yelled, 30 seconds, you just got to go for it. And I did, and I armbarred him. Yes. But
so you just hit a little fist bump.
Yeah, yes. Of course, yeah. Because, you know, I haven't talked about this for a long time. But I got to the guy that I fought next was the guy that I had another match, and then the guy that I fought after that. Oh, that's right. No, I had another match, and I guillotined the guy unconscious. And that was the first time I'd ever seen anybody go out unconscious. And he kind of looked like The Exorcist, because he was making gargling noises and spinning everywhere, and it
snoring.
The snoring was like awful. And then swearing after, so that is also like The Exorcist.
Like when he woke up?
Yeah, when he woke up, of course. He was very annoyed.
Jesus.
And then I had another match, and then and then I had a match against this the guy who won, and he basically just took me down and stalled out.
Right.
And I remember thinking at the time that, you know, this is bullshit, this is ridiculous, but that's comps. You can get away with doing that if you want. It's just the game. The rules are there to be bent. And I competed at blue belt. Now blue belt, I'm not gonna lie, I was pretty decent at blue belt. I got silver medal, where I lost the match in the last like 4 seconds, I think.
Got submitted?
No. So I was up on points, and then the guy got a takedown, so it became 4-all, and yeah, he had one more advantage than I did.
Oh,
so he won by an advantage, and that was really salty. But and then I had another blue belt comp where I did I was just silly at being silly, and I didn't get submitted, but I got mounted by a guy that I beat in that previous comp. And then I competed again at purple, but I think around about that time, actually, in I started training with John, and
outside of SPMA,
yeah, right. That is correct.
At the commune,
that is right. Correct. So to cut a long story short, in 2013, look. I've got nothing bad to say about SPMA. It was great at the time, but it was very clear that there was a rift brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, I started to see that with the coaches, right? So you kind of had to pick a side. You either had to pick Elvis or Anthony. And for Elvis and Anthony to coach you, you would need to pledge allegiances to one or the other, right? Because of that, I started to find that my development of my game really started going downhill. Not in terms of I could definitely fight, but I couldn't develop and learn new skills.
Yeah.
So then John opened up the commune, and he just said, "Hey, come down, man. We'll train together." I just I had a job in the city, and I was I just thought, yeah, sure, why not? I could get some extra training in. So at that time, when Commune was starting to run classes, like afternoons and nights, I was training 12 times a week.
Commune and SPMA.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell me, you can talk on about how you ended up coming, full-time commune, but do you want to give us a little preface on what that was?
So I'd love to, because we don't really talk about that those times, but those times were amazing. So, I mean, thinking back on it, I really liked the idea that, you know, I could train with John. John was someone that, look, pre-injury, because obviously none of you know pre-injury John. Pre-injury John was a very different person. I mean, I can't iterate enough how different he was before he injured his shoulder. He was just a supreme athlete and very, very dedicated to the art. And then after he injured his shoulder, he came back, and strangely enough, around about that time, we started clicking.
Right.
Because I looked at him very differently. Instead of being this supreme athlete that was all really gung-ho and very very straight edge about it, he kind of relaxed a little, because he's like, well, you know, I accept I'm not going to be the best person. I'm not going to be a world champ at this point. I've one arm. Mm. And I'm like, by one arm, I mean he literally had one skinny arm. You ever seen Saba?
Mm.
Has got one skinny arm, one normal arm? Yeah, Johnny was the same. Like, his arms were so disproportionate. And people would... I mean, I remember this, and I don't know if I should say it, but people would, I think, go out of their way to try and kick Johnny's ass in those sessions, because they just could. They could take advantage of his, lack of an arm.
Yeah.
But I remember that we really connected at that point. That would have been about 2011, 2012. And then he split off
but what actually was the commune?
Oh, so the commune was, and I'm getting to that, because he split off from SPMA from some, I guess, infight with Anthony. Now, how that played out, obviously, that's, his place to say.
Sure.
But he split out, so he became, I guess, a Ronin, if you will, right? He didn't have anybody to go under. And he was a purple belt. And, I respected him a lot at the time, because I thought, hey, here's one of the OG guys that the day that I walked in to SPMA, he was basically looked at as the man.
Mm-hmm.
And now I got to train with
him.
With him, yeah.
Yeah.
So he started the commune. So the idea behind the commune was that... he could just train jiu-jitsu. Anybody could train. He didn't care about politics. He didn't care about affiliations. He's just like, come down. Anybody can train.
Was it a little bit like open sparring in that sense?
It was, but open sparring doesn't have a head instructor.
Yeah.
Jiu-jitsu commune had a head instructor. So
right.
John would still teach.
Yeah, okay.
And then for the longest time, so after he did his first... class, where he invited everybody down. And that's all the SPMA guys and stuff. God, I remember those times. He invited all the SPMA guys down and stuff. The commune kind of formed out of his desire to keep training, even though he didn't have someone to train under.
Right.
Right. So he would still teach, but we didn't really have any syllabus or anything to go off.
Mm-hmm.
Now... what that ended up looking like was, people in the city would just come down and train, but it was just a very eclectic mix, because you get guys who, so I trained with Neuron, or Matt obviously, who was there since day one, Neuron, who was another purple belt.
Is he the Masters guy?
Masters.
So I've overlapped with this. So when I started, it was called Higher Jiu-Jitsu, but it was still run like the commune, because there wasn't a curriculum.
No, of course.
And Niran was there, and it was... know what you're referring to. Maybe John was a little bit further ahead with the way he taught things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was definitely looking for structure when I arrived.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, so when you arrived, we were in the process of transitioning to Pedro.
And what was that time? What was the time between starting the commune and me arriving? Like, how long were you sort of running the commune as the commune?
You arrived in 2015, didn't you?
I arrived at the gym in February 2016.
2016, okay, cool, yeah. cool. All right. I guess I can just keep talking about it. So the timeline, back to where we were, the timeline for you joining and us going from Jiu-Jitsu commune to high Jiu-Jitsu,
mm-hmm.
that really happened in 2015. I remember that we made the transition to high Jiu-Jitsu in 2015, because basically what happened was, to give you some more context about Jiu-Jitsu commune, it was a very strange, I mean, it was tons of fun, and I'll always remember it very fondly, but it was very strange because no one really cared so much for the gym. We just cared that it was up and it was still running, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there were times when it would just be John and me. There were so many classes when it was just John and me, and sometimes Matt and Matt Howard, who I don't know if you met, and another guy called Adam. When we had a class of five, that was like, wow, we had a class of five.
We are getting big.
We are blowing up. That was so funny back in the day. And now the way John also used to teach was we just teach whatever, man. Like, honestly, there was very little structure. He'd just rock up and just show some stuff and, you know, we'd warm up for a bit. He'd rock up and show some stuff and it was very loose. And sometimes John didn't even show and it was just me. And I had to teach and I had to take the class, which was really interesting because, you know, John was a purple belt, I was a purple belt, and then I just kind of had to think of something to do. Now, the real, I guess, pain period came when we were sitting down, and I still remember this, in the car. We were parked in BP Petrol Station at Redfern. It was one night, we just had a class, and I think 5-6 people showed up to it. And it was so clear that the way that we were going was unsustainable, right?
Right.
Because the people that turned up were all, they had no loyalty to anything, really.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. I'm not saying that I don't have loyalty, but no one had any loyalty. No one had any kind of foundational understanding of, but some people didn't even have a foundational understanding of Jiu-Jitsu, mm-hmm. and some people were purple belts. So it's just a really, really strange mix, and we just couldn't get off the ground. We also had Grigor, bless him, who I want to say that I got my cauliflower from Jiu-Jitsu, but really I got it from Grigor. There's another way to put it.
At least on one ear.
No, both.
Oh, right.
Yeah, no. Think about this, right? Correlation, causality. I've been training Jits for... I was training Jits for 6-7 years at the time.
Yeah.
Trained with Grigor for 6 months, right? 6 months, that's when my cauliflower popped up. I don't know, is this conspiracy? But I love Grigor. But so the commune really got to the point where I guess John was a good teacher, but he didn't seem to want to teach. And then there was the Pedro Sauer seminar at that time that, oddly enough, I didn't go to. And then John obviously met Phil and they started chatting and, you know, they started talking about Pedro Sauer because, strangely enough, at the time, as in when we were high Jiu-Jitsu, because we were talking about affiliation for a long time, or when we were Jiu-Jitsu commune, sorry, we were talking about affiliation.
With just someone.
With just someone, yeah. We need to find someone, yeah.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of people were floated around, and I remember John saying, I mean, there's Pedro Sauer as well. And I was very dismissive because I was like, no way Pedro Sauer would affiliate with, you know, a bunch of guys in Woolloomooloo. But then I thought about it for a while and I thought, look, anything is possible. Like, you just got to be open enough. Because back in those days, like, as Jiu-Jitsu commune, it seemed absurd to think that Pedro Sauer, who, you know... Back in those days, I knew who he was from the Lance Batchelor fight and from the YouTube channel that I used to love called Submissions 101, which is run by a purple belt from a Pedro Sauer affiliate.
Right.
That was a great channel, by the way. Highly recommended to any of you guys listening, Submissions 101. Now, we floated the idea about affiliation, and then John started talking to Phil, and you know, that sort of stuff started happening. And then next thing I know, Johnny just we're sitting in the car after class, and he goes, okay, we're going to call ourselves High Jiu-Jitsu, and we're going to affiliate with Pedro Sal.
And this was before it had even been talked to Pedro.
This is before. No, this was as in through Phil.
Yeah.
So it was obviously through Phil. And that came as a massive shock to me, because like my world got flipped, turned upside down in a heartbeat, because I'm like, I don't want to affiliate. I don't want to learn something new. I don't want to do anything, any of that. Like when I left SPMA, like, it was essentially, like I spoke to Anthony, and he was like, well, you know, if you grade, you'll get your brown belt. And at the time, I kind of dismissed it as like, oh yeah, cool, whatever. But in hindsight, I was like, damn it.
I could have my brown belt by now.
But anyway.
Yeah.
But so for me, I was just like, I don't want a syllabus. Syllabus is terrible. I used to dread grading. I used to dread even thinking of learning a syllabus and you know, set moves. Because to me, jiu-jitsu was all about, you know, De La Hiva guard and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, Johnny just said, we're affiliating. This is just, it is what it is. You can go if you want. But I'm sticking by it. And of course, in hindsight, it's good that we stuck by it, but we argued for a long time because I didn't want to change.
Yeah.
I didn't want to change. And,
but you also knew that it wasn't sustainable.
I knew that it wasn't sustainable, but I didn't want to change. So I would look,
you just thought that it would work out eventually.
Yeah, exactly. I just thought that, I mean, I wanted there to be a point where obviously the gym was still able to run and sustainable, but at no point in time did I think that, you know, we had to learn a syllabus and I had to basically learn a syllabus from scratch.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, not even, you basically had to learn the blue belt syllabus too.
I had to unlearn everything that I did. Because I remember the first time that Phil came down and he brought Ryan down, and I rolled with Phil, and in my head, because this was the first time I'd met Phil essentially, right? And in my head, I'm like, okay, I'm going to show you, like, I don't need to unlearn anything, Phil, like, let's throw down. And so I threw everything I had at that guy, and he finished with an armbar. And he armbarred me so hard that I popped my rib. Like I was out of action for, as in, I couldn't move my right hand, my right side for probably about 6 weeks.
Was he going real hard because you?
Yeah,
were?
No. Well, of course, because I was going real hard. But that's the that was the last time I rolled with Phil properly.
Properly.
Yeah. That was the last time I rolled with Phil. And I mean, obviously, like, you know, we drilled stuff, but I haven't rolled with him since, but I popped my rib. And then I had, I was training with, I rolled with Ryan immediately after. And here I am with a popped rib, and I'm like, I can't even breathe properly because every time I inhale, my ribs hurt a lot and my diaphragm is seizing up. So I'm like, yeah. And we got to bowing out, and, you know, I can't remember, I'm sending it to Ryan. And I basically pass out, like, as in I lose consciousness. I walk over to the site and sit down and I lose consciousness. And then I wake up like a few, like 10 seconds later, but no one really saw.
No one knew?
No one knew. I passed out. Cause I had a popped rib and stuff. But then I guess the real sense of defeat was from, I guess I got to like just scrap everything and learn a new syllabus from scratch.
Yeah.
Because that has been really tough. Like, for me to unlearn a lot of, like, all the way that we do the armbar, right? The way that I do the armbar has changed.
Yeah.
The way that I did the cross collars changed. Everything had to be just scrapped and thrown out the window. And that was very tough. Mm. It still is tough.
Matt echoed the same thing.
Yeah.
And even John has said to me on various occasions that he finds it easier to teach someone who's never trained before because they're a blank canvas and he can show them the way.
Yeah.
Compared to someone who's experienced jiu-jitsu from somewhere else, and then, you know, not that it's not good jiu-jitsu, but it's just not the brand or the same style that our curriculum expects you to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously you already being a purple belt makes it even more difficult to backtrack.
Yeah, oh God, it was supremely difficult to even think that I'd have to succumb and learn a new syllabus. Because you gotta understand that, okay, the thing that really changed was not my jiu-jitsu itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, that obviously changed, but the way I treated the art, if that makes sense,
mm-hmm.
That had to change. Like, that was by far and away the hardest thing to change. For me, I was just like, okay, if I roll with someone and I tap them, good. My work here is done. I've been validated or verified as being good at jiu-jitsu. But the way that the professor and the Pedro Sao system treats the art itself is not, it has nothing to do with rolling, right? Mm-hmm. How you go in a roll or how you go in a comp, irrelevant, right? It's much deeper than that. And to have to go deeper into the art was one of the toughest things. To this day, has to be in like top five toughest things I've done in my life.
Mm.
To unlearn and to go deep on the art and actually understand and have to understand the way the art is, and, you know, to understand Elio Gracie as opposed to IBJJF sport jiu-jitsu or jiu-jitsu for MMA.
Yeah.
To have to understand the Elio Gracie way, unbelievably tough. Because it's like going to someone and saying, you know, Brad, you're from Perth, you speak with an Aussie accent, I want you to speak Chinese. Speak Chinese now.
Gumboy?
Yeah. not bad.
That's like literally the only word I know.
No, but there you go. It's a new language. It's so different that if me now
mm-hmm.
rolled with me at my peak of training 12 times a week, if we rolled together, that guy would probably just be as likely to beat me now as, you know, as I would be to beat him. But I think who would be a better teacher and who would have a deeper understanding
mm-hmm.
of the art? Me now, like 100%.
Well, and who's going to stay on the mats for 40 years?
Well, yeah.
Compared to who's not.
Yeah. I think the funny thing about that, actually, and I want to talk about that philosophy about staying power, because I think a lot of people don't really understand what that means in terms of staying on the mat. Like, you know, you want to be able to stay on the mat for 40 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Physically is one thing, mentally is something else entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I feel like a lot of people say, okay, well, we don't want to get injured, you know, our bodies break down and we can't obviously train anymore, right? That's one way to look at it. But I think there's another massive, massive area of jiu-jitsu that gets overlooked in terms of the staying power, is that mentally you have to find new things to work on, you have to find new ways to look at the art and that sort of stuff, which under the IBJJF style is fundamentally unsustainable. Like, you're not going to have 40 years of IBJJF.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because under in competition, you win by doing a set move that you've drilled to death and you just execute it then and there, right? But you can't do that for 40 years. No one can. No competitor has a 40-year career, right? It doesn't make sense. But mentally, you need to look at the art differently. Like, wake up and look at the art differently every day. That's how you stay on the mat. Not just not getting injured, because there are many competitors I know that don't get injured, that, or many guys I know that train and don't get injured and still do that sport style.
But they retire eventually.
Yeah, yeah, but it's you lose interest. How can you possibly train on the mat for that long if, you know, you want to look at competition? Or that style of jiu-jitsu, you can't do it.
I guess that's why they... I mean, to defend that style of jiu-jitsu, and for someone who would be actively competing on the regular, that's why they have master's divisions and things like that.
Yeah.
And it keeps those sorts of people involved in jiu-jitsu.
Exactly. Funny that, I'm just going to say this now. Here's a recipe for success in competition jiu-jitsu, right? If you want to win a competition, do not roll. Rolling proves nothing. If you want to win a competition, you need to pick a set sequence of moves that you learn and you drill. And you drill under full resistance until you can get them so good under full resistance
that you can rely on them.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Every competitor I've ever seen in my life does this, right? There's no way to win, right? So I don't know if you've heard John Danaher's explanation of how there are open systems and closed systems in jiu-jitsu, and competitors can win by being open and just reacting to everything as they come, or they can win by being closed and having a set sequence of moves. And there are great competitors on either philosophy, right? But until you get to the ADCC, that level, you are realistically only going to win via a closed system. So that's a series of attacks that you drill down. And I think if anything, Aaron proves
that.
Because we drilled for 2 months, right? And I think the biggest reason why I wanted to drill that with him is obviously he's athletic, and B, his mind is easy to mold because he's done swimming and he understands
what he wants to compete.
He wants to compete, that sort of stuff, But I mean, it's the fact that, look, if you want to win, don't roll. Don't derive any enjoyment. Honestly, don't derive any enjoyment from your training, because you're not there to enjoy. You're there to win.
Yeah.
And if you want to win, don't roll.
Yeah.
Pick a series of moves and drill them to death.
Well, it's funny you say that, because one of Danny's questions on Saturday in the seminar, was about, you know, we have one guy in our gym who's big and strong and he gets the side control and I can't get out, i.e. he was referring to Aaron. And Pedro Sauer, basically, the resolution was, hey, don't fight that when he's doing that. Wait until he tries to progress and go to mount and then... look for the escape or look for the sweep, and that's your moment. Don't resist against him and try and escape while he's in that position trying to hold you, because you are safe. You're not going to get hurt, but you're just going to exert and waste energy. And sort of, if you're looking at jiu-jitsu through the lens of the Pedro Sauer Association and the philosophies that we have in our training and in self-defense on the street, that's exactly what you should do.
Yeah, it was no time limit.
That's no time limit. But if you're looking at through the IBJJF...
No, well, then you've just spent 5 minutes under side control.
You've spent 5 minutes underneath Aaron, and Aaron's won on points because he's passed your guard to side control.
Exactly correct. Exactly correct. And I think that's why we don't actively encourage competition in our gym, because there's no point. If we wanted to compete, we'd have a clock, we'd have a timing clock. If we wanted to compete, we'd have someone that stood there and yelled at the people to be like, that's it, go to mount,
stop stalling, stop stalling,
keep pushing. Which, look, I've been there with SVMA. I've seen what happens with that. It's not pretty. But you can, you know, I mean, you can do it, but it's not pretty.
Does it, being really heavily focused on competition, and I ask this because I'm not, and I mean, I understand this in my mind through playing AFL and cricket. I never used to get nervous playing footy because it's a lot more of a team sport, and you have a lot, you can make mistakes throughout the day, but like there's so many, you know, you've got four quarters, there's so many second opportunities that you get. So you can recover and have a great game, even though you stuffed up several times. In cricket, there's a lot of pressure on yourself, because if you're batting, and I used to open the batting, you could have one bad ball, one really good ball, even if you're in very good form. Bang, you're knocked over. You don't get any runs. And then you might have to wait. You don't bat again that day. Next week, your team fields, so you don't bat. And then the next week in the new game, your team fields again. Mm-hmm. So it's like 3 weeks before you get to bat in a game again. Mm-hmm. You have a couple of bad knocks and a couple of really good deliveries that get you out early. Mm-hmm. It can ruin a whole season. Mm. Like, it really can. Mm. So there is a lot of pressure and like anxiety around like wanting to perform.
Yeah.
And you can carry that like on your shoulders a bit, especially if you compete at like a high level. So my question is, being in a gym, and I'm sure John could elaborate, you might even see this in John looking at the way he used to compete, so you might be able to reiterate, but what was it like being in a competition-focused gym where the stakes and the expectations to compete are really high? Does it change your approach to competition day compared to the approach that like me and other guys in our gym have had when we compete, where we're not too fussed? Like, we want to win, but we're not.
Yeah.
We come to the gym the next day with smiles.
You don't need to win. You don't need to win. It's
It doesn't ruin my week.
It's very different. It's about being in a comp gym, the idea behind your training, like as in the training style that you adopt in the gym, that's your A game. You bring your A game to everyone, mm-hmm. right? And you just drill down your A game. Look, the way John teaches, the way the whole association really goes about training is your A game is, there is no A game, right? You're good anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think for John, I mean, for the longest time, and I see our entire gym going this way as well, which is quite interesting. John was very much, since day one, he was very like a bottom player, right? As in, you know, he had a great guard. I mean, he was great on top as well, but he had a really strongly emphasized guard game, and his passing style was all about pressure and that sort of stuff. But now, you know, the way he treats side control is just, okay, cool, I'm in side control. He's impossible to pin down in side control. It's very difficult to mount him as well. So I think the whole thing is, in competition focused gyms, or even gyms that don't teach under like our style, for instance, they look at the art in terms of the A game, right, as opposed to the game,
right.
Like me now, I probably won't use my A game or the stuff that I'm working on at that time. I probably won't use that against anybody in the gym, maybe one or two people in the gym a week max.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when you really put the pressure on.
Yeah.
And when you do, like I've had roles with you where it's like back and forth, we trade positions, like ultimately you're tapering it to my level or 5% above.
Yeah.
And then there's roles where, and someone made a comment, I think it was, it might have been Nick or Brendan, and he said with Oscar, one of them, I can't remember who it was, and it's true though, he said with Oscar you either get a really playful role or you slap hands and he fucking comes for you.
Yeah,
and it's so true, because I remember we rolled probably in the last few weeks where you were hunting, like full on hunting for the cross collar chokes, and you submitted me like 3 or 4 times with one, and it was like, okay, well obviously that's what you're working on at that point in time.
But that's the funny thing, isn't it? Because to be completely true, and this is where I always kind of look, I am obviously Pedro Sal, but every once in a while I just want to bring the ruckus.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Time and a place.
Because exactly right. Because the whole idea behind the A game, I mean, this is the thing, right? The A game is your comp game, and that's the game that you play, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever move you want to do and whatever move you want to learn. If you want to be the Kimura guy, then you just be the Kimura guy. But I think one of the best ways to really learn the art is to choose one thing. So for me, you're right, it's been the cross collar, and I've tried to drill that down for about a month now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the end of the month, which is coming up quite soon, I will probably park the cross collar to one side and promise to myself to not use it again for a long time and pick up something completely different. And I think that's a really, I think that's a good way to look at the art in terms of understanding and focusing on a particular move in a particular sequence of positions. Cause, and I'm glad we're talking about this now, a lot of people like to learn the art as a, as kind of like sampling, if that makes sense. As in, you know, if you were going to make a song,
mm-hmm.
and you would take little snippets from everyone else and put them all together and make them into a, make them into a, like a song based on samples.
Right.
But really, what I think the best way to really learn the art itself is to go, okay, I'm going to learn drums or whatever, right? I'm going to learn how to make drums sound good or something like that, and focus on that, and then make a very drum centric song.
Yeah.
Therefore, not only do you learn, not only do you learn music as a whole, but you learn, of course, a little component of music that's very useful.
That you become very good at.
Yeah, exactly. And that doesn't work for everybody, but I think, you know, doing away with what you're working on at the moment, and then, you know, trying to constantly reinvent and trying to constantly come up with new things to look at. Like for a while there, I was trying to do the armbar.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually at that time. That's when Aaron obviously was learning the armbar too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the only real way to learn the art itself is to, you know, come up with new things, and you know, use them in rolling and try and understand them, and then park them to one side and try not to use them again.
Yeah. Well, not again, but just not rely over, yeah, rely,
yeah,
on them.
Yeah.
I remember. Yeah, that's so true, because if you close your mind to other things and you look for the one thing, you rely on the one thing, you can really stifle your ability to learn new things if you just always go to that one place. Like for me, it was the bow and arrow early on. That was the one thing I kept on. I got good at, and I can move into that position without thinking. I can just feel it and do it now. So I feel like I'm getting proficient there, but there's other areas where I'm not good at all. And it's like, okay, I can keep looking for something that I know I can get, or I can maybe start attaching other submissions from that same setup, so you can start linking new things together and creating more like muscle memories and more better understandings. But then I'm at the point now where, like, from the back, I've got that, an arm bar, a couple of different chokes, like 3, 4, 5 different setups from the back that I can all do, and they all look like the same setup, but it's just minor adjustments to execute different submission.
Yeah.
And that was all built also around trying to just get a solid back control.
Yeah.
Because that's how you don't get submissions if you don't have that.
No.
But then now it's like, well, now I need to work on other things, not even in that area. Like guard. My mind is guard. I need to improve my guard because I've been too free with opening my guard and trying to sweep people with like knee shield. So it's hard to not do that.
Mm.
How do you, for people that are trying to, what's the best way to,
well,
to get past that? Because if it's like what you know and it becomes instinctive.
Yeah. Well, I guess the most scalable way to learn is to essentially take one thing and focus on that. And then once you think you at least understand it a little bit, park it to one side and don't use it again.
Mm-hmm.
And then find something else to work on. For beginners, that should always be, you know, protecting yourself from side control, mount, whatever it is, right?
Yeah. How to recover your guard from side control. Yeah, in fact, when you do lose it.
In hindsight, if I was a beginner, I would lie down on my back and basically let the more advanced person, take side control, mount, whatever it is, and try and stay safe, right? Mm-hmm. If you get submitted, I mean, obviously don't let yourself get submitted, but just try and stay safe. And if you don't get submitted, that's a win. And work your way out from there. Even now, if I was going to choose to learn something in the art, I'd always choose defense over attacking, you know, like offensive positioning, because I guess at the end of the day, there's no real reason why you'd want to attack unless there was a time limit, I think.
Mm.
There's actually no real reason to want to attack. I mean, obviously you want to try and advance your position when you can, but there's no reason to attack.
Mm.
there's a reason to maneuver, but you don't need to attack, and you don't need to like attack the back, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You just need to make sure that you're not getting submitted. And look, if the back incidentally turns up, then it turns up.
Yeah.
But I feel like that philosophy ensures that not only will you be, will you learn more, but you'll be happier on the mats. Your success isn't defined by, oh, I got my guard pass. No, who gives a crap? There's no referee.
Mm.
Like, when I referee, I don't care who wins and who loses. I just care that I don't see someone break their arm in two. And obviously, I don't get yelled at from coaches and stuff. But you see these guys that they live and die by their happiness rests on the outcome,
mm.
right? And that's no way to look at it. That's no way to look at jiu-jitsu at all.
I guess that was the aspect I was looking at when I asked about the pressure to perform. Tell me a little bit about your competition. How did you get, or not competition, sorry, refereeing. How did you first get involved with that? And do you enjoy doing it?
So I only ref at Grappling Industries and sub-only comps, right. specifically because I don't like the whole advantages thing. Like I could ref it if I wanted to.
Mm.
But I got into refereeing because Ben Hodgkinson, who runs Grappling Industries and is a really good black belt, he posted an ad wanting referees for his sub-only competition. He's just like opened to purple belts, and I thought, yeah, screw it, I'll do it. And specifically, I wanted to do it because A, you can make money. It was cool.
Mm-hmm.
B, you get a free acai bowl. Amazing. And free pizza. Also amazing. You get to hang out with some cool people.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to watch some jits. It's a win-win for everybody. Mm. So that's why I started doing refereeing. And the other big thing is because I had a curiosity in my head that I was curious to see what worked and what didn't,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. And in, you know, watching jiu-jitsu for 8 hours a day, for how, you know, 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day sometimes, you start to see patterns. And I now, hand on my heart, can say, I know what works.
Mm.
It's not pretty, but I know what works.
Yeah.
It isn't, and I guess that's the big thing for me with refereeing. Like, refereeing is still fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this last comp I had with the sub only, you learn a lot about what works, right, from refereeing, which you can't look at if you just go there as a spectator. Because as a spectator, you can tune in, tune out, you can, you know, shout at your guy because, you know, you're supporting someone
yeah.
who's your person. But as a referee, you have to be objective.
Like yeah.
You cannot have any bias. But you can therefore, because you don't have bias, you can find out what works.
Yeah.
So now I know what works.
Yeah. You told me a little bit earlier,
mm-hmm.
I think, well, we were talking about this before mm-hmm. the podcast started. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned on the podcast, though, that you haven't competed for about 4 years.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that there was a point in time where you decided that you didn't want to compete and you yes. started to move away from that. Do you want to tell me about that properly? Because you sort of
absolutely
mentioned it, yeah. but we didn't go through it.
Yeah, no. I've told this story a few times, but I don't think I've really gone into it in dim depth, so I might as well talk about it. So the point for me that really changed for me to really look at jiu-jitsu and go, okay, you know what? I shouldn't learn. There's no point in learning De La Hiva. There's no point in learning these tricks of the trade. And that point was, so I was a blue belt, right? And Jiu-Jitsu Commune had been open. This was in early 2014, right? Jiu-Jitsu Commune had been open for not very long, but I can't remember the exact time, actually. But anyway, and I was at Maroubra Beach, right? And I parked my car at Maroubra Beach and went to... actually, it would have been 2013 even. And I parked my car at Maroubra Beach and, you know, went to go swimming and stuff and came back to my car and there was a guy leaning on it and... He was big. He was like Tony Earl's size, I think.
Yeah.
He was a big dude. And he had a beard like Tony Earl's and he was basically just Tony Earl's with tattoos. And a bit meaner.
So probably not as nice as Tony Earl's.
Probably not as nice as Tony Earl's, yeah. But he was leaning on my car, and I guess, and you know, he started yelling at me. You know, he was like, "Why are you parked in my spot, etc." And then when I didn't respond to that, he started yelling, like just hurling like racial abuse, and just homophobic slurs, everything he could to try and get it, like provoke a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And when I didn't react, he just tried to up the ante constantly. And this guy, like, I gotta be honest, I was scared, but I wasn't, I guess, afraid for the confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely thought, you know, he could have a knife, and anything is possible, right? You just don't know in that situation. And I put my hands up because that's what I'd kind of learned instinctively to do,
mm-hmm.
to say, you know, look, you know, just chill out, man, just chill out. And I walked towards him, and I was about a meter away, so within striking distance, and I kind of anticipated a strike. And the guy spat at me through my through my guard, as in my defensive
hands,
yeah, and spat at me in the face, and it hit me in the eye. And I remember this. I still remember the feeling that I had at that point, because the guys just, you know, yelled all this stuff at me, like, you know, talked about, you know, Asians and called me gay and gay Asian, whatever you want to call it, just some variant of that.
Yeah.
And he's gone on and on and on. I haven't let it affect me. But then when he spat at me in the face, it's like everything that he said kind of just all hit me at once. And at that moment, I jumped at him and I grabbed him by the head and I grabbed him by the arm, kind of like a, and this is quite funny, I didn't know the T position at the time,
mm-hmm.
but it was the T position. It was a variant of the T position.
Mm-hmm.
And because I launched myself at him, and I guess it took him by surprise because he was standing upright, right?
Yeah.
So because he was standing upright,
his base was no good.
So I jumped at him and I pushed him into a, like, in the T position, lunged with all my weight. The guy would have been about 110 kilos, I guess. I lunged with all my weight and threw him into the wall, right?
Right.
With all my weight. Which in hindsight was probably going to knock him out.
Yeah.
Like, because I forced his head to bang into the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hit his head into the wall again and I yelled something in his ear, like, you know, say that again or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Expecting him to want to fight from that point because mm-hmm. we were in the T position. And then, you know, threw him to the wall and then backed up and was kind of ready to go at that point. And I was terrified, like absolutely terrified, because this guy was big, he had tattoos, he was bearded, and he was, you know, yelling all this crap at me, and he was obviously crazy and drunk and smelled awful, but he didn't do anything. He just stood there and I stood there, and then we had this Mexican standoff and then got in my car and drove away. And that was the first point in time that I ever had to use jiu-jitsu, and I've been doing in a street situation, and I've been doing jiu-jitsu at that time for 6 years. Right, and I never had to use it, and then suddenly, wow, I had to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I don't need to think about De La Riva and all this other stuff, because did I have to use that then? No. The fight starts standing, obviously. So I really thought at that moment that, okay, maybe self-defense is a good thing to learn. And after that point, I didn't really compete as much, because I guess in my head competition started to matter less, because, you know, if I was in competition, I'd just sit on the ground and butt scoot.
Yeah.
Right. No way in a million years would I ever sit on the ground and butt scoot against a guy that's the size of Tony Earls.
Yeah.
Who's angry and drunk and tattooed, like, he'd kick my head in. So that's when I started to think, okay, maybe I should learn this stuff. And then, obviously, we were learning MMA with Gregor and that sort of stuff at the time, and I got my cauliflower ears, my badges of honor, for those that are listening. You should get yours today.
Yeah, I'll give them to you for now.
Exactly. Just put your head in a guillotine and then try and pull your head out, and then just do that for 100 times and you'll get them. Sorry, badges of honor. So the second time that really made me think, okay, and I think this is so funny to think of, that the timing of us going to high jiu-jitsu and this event happening were were, you know, there was a very similar crossover. But basically, and this was the time where I definitively said, look, I don't want to compete anymore. Like, there's no point in me competing. I won't get any enjoyment out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if I focus on competition jiu-jitsu, and I'm in this kind of situation again, my life would be really in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would do something stupid. I probably would do something stupid, and I would engage in a fight that didn't need to happen, and either the guy would get hurt and I'd have an assault charge, or the or I'd get hurt and who knows what would happen. But the whole point about jits now, I think the way I look at jiu-jitsu is to avoid an altercation. So I'll tell this story. So the second time I've ever had to use jiu-jitsu in my life was, I was at a party one time, and to cut a long story short, people were heavily intoxicated, and there was one guy there who thought that I was preventing him from, you know, hooking up with this girl, which I was. I was definitely doing that, and he was correct.
For your, because she was a friend and to protect her?
Yeah, yeah,
or for your self-gain because you wanted her?
No. Oh, no, it was because, in hindsight, it was because I didn't like the guy, and I thought that he was a bit of a dick, so I just thought, you know what, I'll just... And she was my friend, yes, but I just didn't like this guy.
Right.
Because he was just... You know that you'll know that type when you see them.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, like the Geordie Shore kind of built, tanned, you know, they look like they work out of the gym a lot. Guy. And yeah, so he was there and he was just trying to pick up this girl, and I was just, you know, being sly. And he waited until the end of the night when everyone had left, and I, because I was, because it was in the middle of nowhere as well, and I was just partying and not thinking anything of it. And he waited to the end of the night when everyone had left, and he came up to me and was like, you know, were you trying to cock block me? And I said, no, man, I wasn't. And he started getting like really close to me and up in my face, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he put his fist next to my face to kind of like shirt front,
mm-hmm.
which in hindsight, obviously we know the defense to that, but I didn't know it at the time. But he put his fist close to my face, and I wrist locked him, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm not dealing with this. This is a guy that wants to punch me, so I wrist locked him, and he burned me with his cigarette, and I let go of the wrist lock, and then I kind of realized, oh crap, that kind of sport understanding of jiu-jitsu, because that wrist lock was a sport move,
mm-hmm.
right? That's probably not going to work here. And I was really drunk too, so that doesn't help the situation at all, because you can't really think straight when you're really drunk.
Mm.
And anyway, so after a tense standoff, he walks back, grabs a beer bottle, throws the beer bottle at my head. It misses, but I knew that he obviously had malicious intent at mm-hmm. that point. Now, the party was... I was in the backyard, right, at this party, and... and he walked inside, right? So there's only one exit to get out, right?
So you knew you had to face him again.
I knew I'd have to face him again, because I knew that he'd purposely walked in to block the exit off, because he wanted to fight at that point. Because this guy was, I'm just trying to think of a person in the gym that would be comparable in size to probably maybe Aaron, probably a little bit bigger than Aaron,
mm-hmm.
but you know, built.
Yeah,
built. Anyway. And, like, he would have been at 80, 90 kilos. Like, you know, looked like he worked out of the gym. Anyway, so I just sat there and I think, crap, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And as I'm sitting there, I could hear him, like, you know, bustling around inside the house. So I thought, okay, you know what? I'm just going to try and casually sneak out.
Mm-hmm.
And I could hear him coming down, and I walked around the side of the house and kind of hid in the back garden, right? To see him as he walked out. And as he walked out, and I'll never forget this image, his whole skin was like red and his eyes were bloodshot, and he looked like a demon, like he was actually possessed by a demon. And he was so angry, like, you know, you could see him and he's like a raging bull.
Mm.
And, I thought, oh crap, this is not good. This is not good because I'm trapped here in this backyard, and I got to think about how I get out of this because, you know, this guy's willing to throw a beer bottle at my head and burn me with a cigarette. Like he's not screwing around. He wants business. He means business.
Yeah,
and he wants to fight. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try and I need to move the fight out of this area. So then I sprinted into the house and then out the door, right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously he saw me sprint.
Followed after.
And I turned around and like looked behind my shoulder. I could see him. He was about 2-3 meters away.
Mm-hmm.
And he's running after me. He's like, and he's breathing really heavily. And he obviously wants to take my head off. But I knew that I needed to move the fight into an open space. So if you're ever in an altercation, the first thing you want to do is if you're in a room, right, like a room where there's, you know, obviously the exits are blocked off, you want to try somehow to move the fight into as open space as you possibly can.
You don't want to get cornered.
No, you don't want to get cornered. Exactly right. So if anything, especially this is one-on-one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, one-on-one.
Obviously, multiple is different, but
you want to have protection by, you don't want people to come at you from all angles.
Exactly. So what I did, I ran into the most open space that I could, which was at the front of the house, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's a street, right? Now, and I'll never forget this. I think the size of the gym, our gym in Woolloomooloo, is about the same size as the street. Right, same width. Because in my head, as I ran into that space, because I was really drunk, but I suddenly sobered up completely, and I just kept thinking, okay, you're not in a street fight, you're in the gym.
Yeah,
right? you're not anywhere. You know, you're just in the gym. And the guy started running at me, and he started throwing these huge haymaker punches, like one after another, and in hindsight, if I had the pizzazz, like the kick to the thigh, I would have used that. But I didn't have that weapon at the time, so I just ended up running backwards, and I ran backwards in a circle. And what I'd do is I'd let him charge at me like a bull, and then throw a few punches. And as he went to throw, I'd step to the side, walk around, right?
Yeah.
And I did that for, it would have been maybe 5 minutes, but it felt like an eternity. And I think, you know, in hindsight, he probably would have been on some kind of crazy hard drug like meth or cocaine or something really hard to make him go crazy, because he would not relent. This big guy with his big muscles yelling and screaming and kicking and everything. And that altercation went down, and then eventually he died, like his energy dissipated, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it took a long time, and he got really tired, like really tired. And I could see that because I let one of his kicks connect, and it was like a, you know, like a child had hit me.
Yeah.
Like there was nothing behind it. And I knew at that point that he was very tired, and he walked away. And then the next, two days later, I came to the gym, and Johnny had just changed it to high jiu-jitsu. And I was like, Johnny, I get the self-defense thing. This thing just happened. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
It'll make sense. And that's really the point where I stopped looking at jiu-jitsu in terms of a 5 minute round. But you know, this is an art that saved my life, or that could save anybody else's life.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Yeah, and you mentioned that it was this point in time you realized that it was an art and that the self defense thing worked. And this coincides with higher jiu-jitsu. And then obviously a little while later, Pedro Sauer. And you mentioned earlier about rolling with Phil. And obviously we're under, you know, through Pedro Sauer, we're under Phil's tutelage as well.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, you didn't mention it at the time, but I want to give you the opportunity now. Now that we've been involved with that association and Phil and Pedro for as long as we have,
mm-hmm.
I want your opinion on where things are at now, where things are going, and just your overall view of the future of the academy.
And then
we can wrap this up if you will.
Absolutely. Okay, so look, being I guess student, you know, number the first student,
well, you're also a coach really.
Thank you. I mean at the end of the day, if someone has a question, right, I'll answer it.
Mm-hmm.
If someone asks me a question, I'll answer it. You know, and I'll try and help people out where I can. But the way I see it, John is the coach because he's the main line to Phil and the main line to Pedro,
mm-hmm.
right? But thank you. So to answer your question, so where do I see the gym going? Okay, so if you were to plot on a direct timeline, right? Because, you know, the gym started with myself, with John, myself, and then Matt, mm-hmm. right? And we were the three amigos for a long time. If you were to plot in a timeline, like the way the gym's grown over the years, look, obviously the first 3 years were, or the first 2 years were just, they were good. I had a lot of fun, but nothing really happened, right? It's kind of like, you know, if you quit your job and just kind of bum around, right? Or you go traveling and stuff, right? Traveling is fun.
But your career doesn't move forward. Your career
doesn't move forward. Exactly, yeah. Right, yeah. So for me, like I've seen so many people come and go, like so many people, you know, everyone under the sun. And the first people that came to the gym when it was Jiu-Jitsu Commune were, they were lost, right? They were lost. Everyone was lost. The whole gym was lost. It was just, you know, no one really had any direction. No one really had any kind of way to move forward and see the future, you know, of their progression. But over time, as the gym started to really, you know, affiliate and grow with the syllabus and stuff, you can really see that the gym has been able to crystallize what jiu-jitsu means for the people that are in it, as opposed to, you know, it goes from being people that are lost to people that are really, I guess, found, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like they understand and they know where they're going and they know what the art is about and they understand what makes them happy in the art. And I think obviously, and I want to be clear in saying this, that, you know, with all the respect I have for Phil, I think the way Johnny teaches and the way John is going to teach in the future is just so different. Like the way he treats the art in terms of the, you know, the self-compassion aspect and that sort of stuff, and the real emphasis on, you know, the way we do warm-ups and stuff, which is like yoga, and the way we you know, actively encourage each other, and, you know, everyone's all happy and has fun, and the way that happens is very unique to out of all the gyms I've ever seen in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really speaks volumes as to where the gym is at right now, because the way John treats the art isn't in terms of, you know, how do I, you know, ensure the survival of the gym, if that makes sense. Like, you know, so we affiliate, we do all this sort of stuff, but it's mm-hmm. now,
yeah, he wasn't looking for a way to survive.
Yeah, yeah, it's like he's now looking for a way to flourish.
Exactly.
Which is oddly the name of our best membership. but yeah, that's really what it's about now. I think that now the gym is so clearly, like, it's just so clearly a gym now, like a fully fledged gym.
Yeah.
You know, we have competitors, we have coaches, we have merch, we have everything that any other gym ever would want. We have, right?
Mm-hmm. We have a community.
We have a community, exactly. That's right. The thing. Yeah, exactly right. And I think that's something that we didn't have, because Commune was really every man for himself.
Yeah.
Right? People would just abandon it willingly because they could, right? You get guys who'd walk in and be like, yeah, I've trained martial arts. Martial arts being a very broad brush term for, I've had a street fight or something, you know, I've done Taekwondo for a few years. But that's really where the whole, where we started was just in, you know, we'll just take anybody. But now we kick out people, I don't say we kick out people all the time, but a lot of people leave because they don't fit in with the culture, and we emphasize the culture a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're going, God, I don't want to speculate, but I can imagine that the gym will probably hit capacity midway through next year, if not, yeah, early 2019.
Mm-hmm.
By capacity, I mean there will be classes where too many people will attend.
Yeah.
As in, you know, if you attend, you know, if we get more than 30 people on the mats, we realistically can't roll.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing. Do I think we'll be in the PCYC forever? Probably not. I think we'll move. Do I think we'll have other, you know, high jiu-jitsus in Sydney? Absolutely. I think the gym will just grow exponentially past this point. And it's a testament, I guess, to the work that we did in the early years of being lost, right? And trying to figure out why we're here and why what we're doing. Because mm-hmm. now everyone knows what the gym is about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because we spent those years in the wilderness, I guess, as commune and being lost and not knowing what we were doing. I think that's really it. Is that all right?
What do you mean, is that all right, man? That's beautiful. Thank you so much. And I really appreciate you being candid.
No worries.
And even like sharing like your feelings about certain things. Yeah, like really, really good, man. Coming from you, obviously, aside from John, like you really, you and Matt are the two people that are viewed across the everyone in the gym as the other coaches. There's other people that like myself and AJ and Danny and like Nick, and there's other people who take some classes occasionally when there's a need because John's not there or whatever. But we are not coaches. Like you and Matt are actually coaches that can actually help people learn jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, thank you.
So yeah, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it a lot. And I'm glad that it went this kind of way.
Yeah.
Because I know you're like real character.
Thanks,
man. And like this podcast could have gone,
it could have gone so different.
Could have been so different, but this is what I wanted from you.
Yeah.
No. And I'm sure we'll have a lot more in the future.
Absolutely, man.
But yeah, thanks again, man. Nice, and man. To everyone else who's listening, I just want to say, I guess, a couple of quick things real quick. We've got a Instagram page now, which is HJJ_stories_podcast. So if you're not following the Instagram page, please do. Also, we have, please do, and please share it as well so we can grow this, grow the page, because ultimately it's not about growing the podcast. It's about trying to, not for the sake of growing the podcast, that's not what I'm trying to do or want to do. I want it to grow so that we can share stories like Oscar's story, which is so different to Matt's, who they had a similar journey, but it's so different. And it's just interesting to share them. And also it just solidifies and adds more to the community that John and Oscar and Matt and guys like that have put so much time into. It just kind of adds value, helps solidify it, crystallize it, and helps it move forward. And I think that that's a really cool thing. And the other side of that is that if people externally to our gym, if it's just our gym listening, that's amazing. That's all we want, really. But if people externally hear about the podcast and then through that join the gym, that's going to help grow it even more. So it's all about just trying to grow that and build that, and because it's so beautiful. So, yeah, follow the Instagram page. Share the podcast with friends and whatever, and hopefully we can just get more people at all levels, all ages, all sexes and everything involved in what we're doing, because it's a good thing.
Yeah, man. Sick.
On that note, thanks everyone. Thanks, brother.
Thanks, brother.